We are facing a time now, we are in a time, I should say, of spiritual crisis. It has been increasing for quite a few centuries. It began with the excessive intellectualism of the scholastics, who were, if legend has it right, quarreling over how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. Religion had been reduced to too much intellectuality and fine points of definition. But then came Copernicus, who began to say that the Earth is not the center of everything, and Galileo, who was threatened with excommunication for saying that the Earth moves around the sun. And he accepted that he was wrong. He betrayed his own conscience because the thought of excommunication was so terrible in those days that he didn't dare go against the church. And yet it is said that he muttered under his breath, "E pur si muove," and in fact, however, it does move. It was only four centuries later, in the 1970s, that the church finally decided to forgive him. This has been a part of the problem, that science has come up and begun to show us a world and a universe that is very different from what people once believed. And all the old mythology has begun to be shaken to the point where people just no longer can believe that God sort of sits on a throne with Jesus at his right side, and there's a sort of a decreasing rank of angels and all the rest of us here. The thought of an eternal hell, I mean, eternity is a long time. People couldn't imagine it years ago. But just think of it, a billion years in eternity is just nothing. And the Christian mythology speaks of a millennium as if that meant something. A millennium is 1,000 years. 1,000 years out of a billion, out of billions and billions. Time, in fact, goes beyond all, it goes into timelessness. But just imagine a young man born into a slum, raised to think that life is nothing but sort of getting what you can at the expense of other people. And he joins a gang for his own protection. And in this gang, at the age of 18, he gets into a gang war and is shot and killed. And before he does that, he shoots and kills somebody else. So we all know what his destiny is, eternal hell, right? For 18 years. And after a couple of billion years, somebody down there asks him, "Well, what are you down here for?" He says, "Well, gee, I don't really remember." A finite cause cannot have an infinite effect. And yet Christianity has been more and more under attack as science has discovered that the Earth is not the center of everything. In fact, it's just a little tiny mud ball spinning on the outskirts of one galaxy. This is very recent knowledge. I remember I was in school in England, and I was born in Romania, so my parents sent me to this school in England when I was old enough to go to it. And a teacher then, this is in the mid-30s, said to me with a look of amazement in his eyes, that, "Do you realize that there are more than one star system? In fact, now science is saying there may be two or even three." Now we know that there's something like 100 billion galaxies, and who's counting? And each galaxy with maybe 100 billion stars. And the universe is so much vaster than we imagined. But at least you think that the rocks are solid and matter is solid. No, the science has gone the other direction too. And it's discovered that in what looks like nothing is space. There is more space in this body than there is solid matter. And that very solid matter, which seems so solid, is really not solid. The discoveries of the past century have been absolutely mind-blowing, that everything is merely a vibration of energy. And that energy yogis would say, and this is what I want to come to later, that it's more than energy, it's consciousness, it's thoughts. Everything was produced out of consciousness. But we'll come back to that. The important thing is that now the churches are in a state of crisis. When I was a young man, I found it difficult to believe in religion. I was raised in an Episcopalian family, and my mother was a devout Episcopalian. I was not. I remember at the age of 16 telling her one day that I would no longer go to church with her. And she wept. It was a heart-tearing experience for me. She said, "What a terrible sadness it is for me to know that one of my own children is condemning himself to death, to eternity in hell." And I felt sadly for her, but there was nothing I could do about it. I had to follow my conscience. It wasn't that I rejected religion, it's that I couldn't accept the way it was taught. And she came to me a few days later with a light of relief in her eyes, and she said that I just read that often rejection is the first step toward a deeper acceptance. And I said, "You have understood." But this need to know, many people by the time they reach my age like to speak of themselves in their youth as having been sort of wild spirits and gay blades and all that. Well, I wasn't. I was in fact very serious about what life is all about. I kept asking, why? It just, nothing seemed to make sense. I wanted when I was 13 to become an astronomer, and I was building my own mirror, and one day when it was almost finished, it slipped off the stand and cracked, and oh, I began to lose heart. And then I thought, well, maybe truth has to be something that touches our hearts. It doesn't matter how vast the galaxy or the universe is, but I need a truth that will somehow have human dimensions to it. And so I tried to find truth in politics. I tried to find it in all sorts of worldly social improvement and so on. And I have the kind of nature which has always felt that if I find a good thing, I want everybody to know about it. But I realized that systems don't make people better. I had grown up, as you know, in Romania, and by then communism had started to come in, and it was trying by killing off everybody who disagrees with you to make everybody the way you think they ought to be. Well, that's not the way to go at it. And other ways of thinking that systems will improve people. People are people. They won't be improved from outside. And I realized they have to be improved from inside by being inspired. And so I thought, well, what can inspire them? And I wanted to become a playwright and a poet. And I had a certain penchant for the arts. And so music was important to me, singing, writing. I wanted to be a playwright. And then the thought came to me, but why do I want to be a playwright? To share truth with others. And I realized I didn't know truth, so why should I impose my ignorance on others? And so I gave it up. And I remember taking a long walk. It was in South Carolina. I was at the Dock Street Theater learning stagecraft. And I took a long walk one night. And I asked myself, what is God? I realized that without something God-like, some spiritual dimension, there can't be any real truth. And I was thinking, what can he be? Well, I'm conscious. I'm conscious enough to ask that question. Where did my consciousness come from? It can't be a product of my brain. Consciousness must be something larger of which I am a part. And when I'm in tune with that consciousness, then I feel more happy and more in harmony. But when I get out of tune with it, I feel disharmony and unhappiness. And what puts me in tune and what puts me out of tune? Well, thinking about myself puts me out of tune. Thinking of what I want for myself puts me out of tune. Thinking of what God wants and thinking of a broader reality makes me feel in tune. I remember an evening that I spent with some friends in college on the beach near Boston. And I walked away from the group and I was thinking this same ocean that laps on these shores is lapping on the shores in Europe and Africa and other parts of the world. And this same sky that seems just over here is the same sky that unites the other continents and all men. And I realize there's something that ties us all together. What can that be? And I became almost, I mean, not just almost, completely desperate. And I didn't want to talk about this with anybody. My father was sent as the petroleum attaché to Romania, and then later he became the head of a geological expedition to Egypt. And my mother went to join him the very day that I put her on the ship. I know that if my parents had been there, this would have been a very difficult step for me to take because it was totally different from anything I understood. I had never heard words that are common to people today. Karma, yoga, guru, dharma, all these things were completely out of my knowledge. But that day, I went down New York, and I found in the Doubleday Duran, as it was called, bookshop there, Autobiography of a Yogi. And when I read that book, I just knew this was what I had been seeking for. I took the next bus across the country from New York to Los Angeles, where Yogananda was, and I went to him, and the first words I said to him, I could never have believed that I would ever address to anybody. I said, "I want to be your disciple." That was nearly 60 years ago. I have followed that. I have never wavered in that thought. It was true. It was just what I'd been seeking. And I am here tonight to share what I consider to be a very, very important message, truth, insight. One of the things that really worried me about Christianity was the lack of attunement with what we know to be real, the mythology of it. Every belief has its own mythology. But the thing is, the criterion of Christianity has always been credo. I believe. And what I believe is not really the proof of anything. People believed that the world is flat. That didn't make it flat. I have believed in some people and they have betrayed me. Belief in anybody is not necessarily a proof that they're reliable. Belief is like the hypothesis in science where you think, well, it makes sense that this should be true, but now let me do the necessary experiments to find out if it's true. What experiments has science offered? Many. What experiments has religion offered? Death. Yeah. When you die, you get to heaven, right? Or the other place. The trouble is, how many people have come back to tell us that they actually made it? And so there is a great gap between what people really feel that they have faith in and what they choose to believe. It says in the Bible, in the Gospel of St. John, as many as received him, to them gave he the power to become the sons of God. What is it to receive Christ? Well, when I was a little baby in arms in Ploiești, Romania, at the little Anglican church in Ploiești, my parents had me baptized. Well, it was a very sweet thing, but I can imagine that my cooperation on that event was just a struggle in protest at the indignity of getting splashed. And so the church, in order to sort of ensure that I was that I really meant it when I was a child and was baptized, they confirmed me at the age of 13. An age when I would not be allowed to have a driver's license, I would not be allowed to vote, I would not be allowed to choose a partner in marriage. In other words, I had not yet reached the age of consent, and so at that time, the bishop rushed in to confirm that I had become a Christian. I don't call that enough. And it wasn't enough. I realized in time that I just have to know. And when I met Yogananda, I found somebody who knew. I was not a gullible person. I was very independent and very doubtful of anything that anybody said, because I wanted to know. I remember when I was 5 years old, mother started to teach me, and she said something like, well, obvious sort of things you'd teach a little five-year-old. And I hauled off and looked at her suspiciously. I said, how do you know? You're just a mother. You're not a teacher. And shameful words. You mothers, don't encourage that too much in your children. Nonetheless, I have to say that that was always my attitude. But when I found Yogananda, I knew that he knew. And the only question I would ask if somebody would be saying something that was supposed to be his teaching, I said, did he say that? If they said yes, then I accepted it. It might seem outrageous, but I accepted it because I knew that he could not be true. But the thing is that I lived with him, yes, with the very questioning mind, but he talked to me and answered questions more than anybody has ever done with him, because I wanted to know and he knew that I wanted to know. And so I have seen over the years, he wrote the commentaries on the life of Jesus and on his teachings. He wrote the commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita. I was with him in 1950 when out at his retreat in 29 Palms. And I, at that time, he had me editing, and he told me at that time that your life is one of lecturing, editing, and writing. And I said, sir, writing? What can I possibly say that hasn't been said already by you? And he looked a little shocked. He said, much more is needed. And in fact, I've seen through my years of writing, I've had the great blessing to be on my own because his organization could not take my independent nature. They threw me out on my ear, and I have considered it the greatest blessing of my life. It was a great pain for a while, but then I discovered I was able to do, at last, the things he himself had told me to do. He often told me, but always in private, you have a great work to do. He told me that this writing and editing was my basic work, but I found, how could I edit? How could I write? In the organization, I'd never have been given the freedom to write. I'd never have had my books published, and I never got the books to edit. Yes, I was the vice president. Yes, I was the head of the monks. Yes, I had some position there, but nonetheless, these things were barred to me. And now on my own, I've been able to write and show how his teachings are relevant in so many different parts of life, like the hub of a wheel with spokes that go out into the world, into education, into marriage, into business, into all these different fields. This is what I have dedicated my life to. I am nobody, but I have dedicated my life to showing how important his teachings are at this time in history. Because I see that we are in a transition time, and man is confused. If you look at the art and music, the literature of the last century and more, it's really appalling. You look at Picasso's sort of schizophrenic people, and people call that art. There's, well, at least he had a good sense of humor. One time he showed people a new painting, and they were all saying, oh, wonderful, wonderful. And when the enthusiasm was at its height, he told people, he confessed that it was painted by his pet monkey. But honestly, where is the meaning of it? It's become trivial, it's become shallow. And I have been agonizing all my life to see that truth, ideals, people are losing faith in these things. But more than that, this dichotomy between religion and science is the first thing, the first crack, you might say, in that bowl. It has begun to make people doubt what their truth is all about. It's reduced Christianity, let's face it, to a third-rate power. People go to church, but do they really believe? I don't think very many people really believe. And their belief is an emotional thing. It's not a certainty. If you have true faith, as Jesus himself said, you can say to this mountain, be thou removed into the sea, and it will happen. There was a story of a man who he'd bought some property, and there was a mountain in the way of a beautiful view of a lake. So he decided that with full faith he would move that mountain. And he went to bed after praying for this mountain to be moved, and when he woke up, it was still there. He said, "I knew you'd still be there." How can you really have faith if it's only belief? You can't. Belief comes as the hypothesis. You must do the testing that will make it possible for you to realize. And this is where Christianity has not emphasized. Now, I'll go into that a little bit later. But I want to go on with this theme of the crisis that we're living in today. That nowadays, in fact, for years I used to want to write about what my guru said. He told me to edit, and I edited his Omar Khayyam. I edited his Bhagavad Gita. It was interesting, that story. This was a year ago, and I had been praying to Yogananda some years before. I said, "How can I edit your Gita and have it the way I remember?" Because I was with him when he wrote it. I was with him when he was. I helped him with editing, but I was a junior. I was only 23 years old, and you couldn't expect my work to be taken seriously at that age. But I prayed to him, "Sir, how can I get your manuscript? It's in the archives. I can't get a SWAT team to go there and take it. It's there." And then in my dream, he said, "But don't forget the possibility of a skylight." And this, in fact, is what happened. This was in October of last year. I was thinking, it's time in my life here, I'm 80, it's time to really get down to doing these more serious works, which I've been putting off out of fear of the responsibility. But I started to write on it, and it just wouldn't come. I didn't know how to do it. Then Jyotish and Devi were coming to visit me. I am living in India. I've come here for this launch, but my home at present is in India. And the day that they were to come, I thought, I've got to do something or it'll be put on a shelf for who knows how long. So I really sort of dived into it. And then I discovered all of a sudden that I had planned to just do a little outline. I found that stanza by stanza, I remembered what Yogananda told me. It wasn't a word-for-word memory, but it was a very clear ideational. I remembered the things, the ideas that he had presented. And I wrote that thing. They came on October 7th. I finished it on December 5th. That's less than 2 months for the whole Gita, about a 600-page book. Not possible. But I just knew what I was doing. I just knew that this power was flowing through me. Sometimes I would sit there after writing a chapter and giving it to others to read, and I would feel the great power of Om, the Holy Spirit, flowing through me, and I would just be so engrossed in that. And I felt that was God's response, saying, "Yes, you're doing the right thing." And so this new book, which came, I have felt very dedicated to doing it. But the thing that really pushed me into it was the Da Vinci Code, if you can believe it or not. I realized how much absolute bilge is being written in this day and age. And it's a very well-written book, but it's absolute nonsense. And I read that 45% of Christians have had their faith shaken by that and other books like it. The Judas Gospel, put out by such a responsible and reputable institution as the National Geographic. And it's nonsense. First of all, its date of recording is 3 or 4 centuries after Christ. But when it says that Jesus told Judas that there are 19 gods, isn't one of the basic principles of Judaism that Jesus himself endorsed, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one"? I just put the book aside. I have read quite a lot of this bilge because it's my job. I need to know what's I need to know what people are saying in order that I can address it. But when I saw that this was coming up, I wanted, a year ago, I was in Milan, Italy, and I wanted to go to see the They've refurbished the Last Supper, the Cenacolo. And I wanted to go see it. And they said, oh, you can't get in there. It's too crowded. I said, what is it? Oh, people who have read the Da Vinci Code. I felt finally it is becoming urgent that we understand what the message of Christ was. I'm not writing, and I didn't write this book as a disinterested scholar. I wrote it with deep devotion for Jesus and for the message that he gave. I lived with a man of God, and I knew how different such people are from the normal run, you might say, of the mill in Christianity. And I wanted to show that as I've dedicated this book for those Christians those sincere Christians whose faith has been shaken. 45% have been shaken just by one book. People are more and more, they've reached the point where they say, well, I happen to be somebody who believes in God. For God's sake, why happen to? You should be proud that you have some sense in your head. The fact is, and this is what I wanted to talk about tonight, the real custodians of religion are those who have practiced it and realized it. The saints, the masters, they live in all religions. Christianity has no monopoly on sainthood. I asked somebody, while I was in India years ago teaching, a Catholic missionary said to me, what do you mean when you say saint? Because he thought saints can only be Catholics. I said, I mean the Sanskrit word sant, from which our word has been taken. These are old words and old concepts. And in fact, the idea that Jesus Christ came only recently and everything before that was just chaos doesn't speak very well for God's compassion. Of course he has come again and again. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says whenever darkness increases and virtue declines, I incarnate myself as an avatar, as a divine person, in order to bring truth back and set it on its throne again. And for this purpose, Yogananda came. He did not come just as another teacher. Many people in his lifetime, they talked to me themselves. They told me they'd had visions of him, and that was why they came to him. One time he was in Boston, he received, in his early years, he was there for 3 years sort of learning this culture, and he received a letter that was anonymous saying that he was completely wrong in sponsoring Jesus Christ in the West. He said Jesus Christ never lived. He's only a myth created to bring people under the control of church authorities. And Master, he didn't sign his letter, as I said, it was anonymous, but Master wanted to know who he was, so he prayed. And about a week later, he was in the Boston Public Library, and he saw a man sitting by a bench, and he went over and sat next to him. He said, why did you write me that letter? And the man was so startled, he said, what letter? The one in which you said that Jesus is only a myth. How'd you know I wrote that? He said, well, never mind, I have my methods. But then he said, I want you to know that that power which enabled me to find you enables me to know that Jesus was a son of God and that he was everything the Bible says about him. This was his mission to the West. Primarily, it was to bring people back to original Christianity, not that Christianity which is sort of over the centuries become more and more fixed in formality. The real custodians of religion always and everywhere are the saints. In fact, I would go so far as to say that the reason religion in India is really purer than anywhere else is that it's totally disorganized. There's nobody to appoint a commission to say, well, who is this person or that person? And as a result, people individually, if they have a saintly quality, people recognize it. And they don't have to go to Rome to find out if they really are. They just go. But the truth is, that's always been the case. Here in Los Angeles, there was a Clarician monk who developed the reputation for bilocation, which means being able to appear in more than one place at the same time. And people were leaving their congregations to go to his church. Well, this was not really admissible. And so they couldn't make other ministers, other priests, saints. So they had to remove this one. The Catholics themselves describe this as sending them to prison. They sent him to Spain, hoping that his reputation hadn't preceded him. St. Joseph of Cupertino used to levitate. In fact, there was one time when some reigning person in Europe came and just took him by the hand, and suddenly they were both up in the air. Well, this kind of thing is kind of embarrassing, isn't it? It's been known to happen. St. Teresa of Avila had to hang on to her prayer bench, hoping that she wouldn't levitate in front of many other people. But this body is not as real as it seems. Nothing is as real as it seems. Everything is energy. And levitation is one of the things that happen when the consciousness rises to a certain point. There is a story about Sadhu Haridas in India. He performed many wonders. One day he was on a boat on a lake and with a Christian missionary, and Yogananda told me this story. And on this boat, the missionary said, he said to the missionary, because the missionary was trying to convert him, he said, well, what could your Christ do that I can't do or others can't do? And he said, well, because they were on a lake, the missionary said, well, he walked on water. And the Haridas said, what's that all? He stepped out of the boat and just walked on the water, and the boat followed him. And it was very inconvenient. And yet I have to say this, and it's an important truth to remember, because miracles are not in themselves the proof. He fell. He later came back, and he was he came back to the path, and he was liberated in that life, my guru told me. But miracles by themselves are not a proof of sanctity. They're a proof that you've developed certain power, yes, of course. But what's power? Really, being a saint means to love God, means to completely give up the ego and to merge in that one. Now, the trouble with the churches is this, and I'll read it to you from my book. There is a major disadvantage to keeping spiritual authority confined in a hierarchy of prelates. The disadvantage is that institutional hierarchies are composed of human beings, most of whom have at least a few of the flaws common to mankind, among which must be counted pride, jealousy, personal prejudice, intolerance, vindictiveness, pettiness, and a tendency to be judgmental and unforgiving. Any one of these flaws is enough to obscure a person's perception of higher truths. As human beings, as living beings, grow outward from a tiny center, from a seed, or from the first cell created by the union of sperm and ovum, creatures grow outward from their own individual centers. Consciousness of separate individuality is developed most highly in human beings. Attachment to ego is the root cause of every human delusion. People's notions of perfection cannot but be limited, therefore. How can perfection be defined? In human beings, the root cause of imperfection is ego-centeredness. It conditions one's every perception. In smug self-esteem and in people's eagerness to be admired by others, they project personal ambition outward and often assume that institutional promotion raises one automatically to exalted personal importance. And I go on from there, and I'm not going to spend my evening reading to you, although I'd love to. From there, we have to understand that being appointed to a higher position, do you mind if I sit? I'm a little more secure on a seat here. Being a human being, we naturally think that organizations are they're the authorities. We've been raised to that. We think that the higher the position in a church, the more your wisdom and understanding. But what happens if you have, let us just postulate a very real situation. Let's postulate that in this organization, you need an accountant. And you've got a choice between somebody who is not at all really spiritual, but he's a good accountant, and another one who is a spiritual person, but is not a good accountant. Obviously, you're going to have to appoint the person who's a good accountant. You can't have a bunch of fumbling saints around if they don't know what they're doing. And so you appoint the accountant. And then it comes to the point where finally you've got a choice between somebody who's a good accountant and not particularly spiritual, and somebody who is spiritual and a good accountant. Will you take the spiritual person? Not necessarily. People, after all, those who have been appointed and promoted, are mostly people who are good administrators and not spiritual. Who wants his own faults shown up? I mean, it stands to reason. The birds of a feather flock together. You will appoint the person who's not going to embarrass you, the good accountant who isn't spiritual or isn't too spiritual. As a result, church hierarchies inevitably become top-heavy with unspiritual leaders. You cannot find it differently. Of course there will be a few saints who sort of slip in unobserved. Mostly they won't. Mostly these saints are outside or quiet, unobserved. But like your Saint Francis, when the church says that they take credit for his sanctity, why didn't they create other Saint Francis's? He did it. Each person has to stand alone before God. And there are two stories to give you the idea of the normal concept of hierarchy. There was one there were some women who were talking about their sons. And one woman said, well, my son is a priest and everybody who talks to him calls him father. And another one more proudly said, well, my son is a monsignor and everybody who addresses him, they say monsignor. And a third one said, well, mine is a cardinal and everybody who addresses him says your grace. And the fourth one said, well, mine is the Pope, and everybody addresses him as your holiness. And the fifth one was sort of nonplussed. She didn't have anybody. And she said, well, my son is very tall and very big, and everybody who looks at him, he says, oh, my God. And another one was a discussion between a Catholic and a Jew. And the Jew was asking the Catholic, how high can you get in your religion? And he said, well, if you're really serious, you can become a priest. And so what then? Well, if you're a good priest, you may become a monsignor. Well, and then? Well, you can become a bishop, finally a cardinal. Finally, he said, well, if you're really good, you can become the Pope. And the Jew said, you mean, is that all? And the Catholic said, what do you want, Jesus Christ? The Jew said, why not? One of our boys made it. But it really is not a pyramid. God is center everywhere, circumference nowhere. How did God create the universe, really? He was not a carpenter who could get out there and buy his wood to make a table. There was nothing in existence except his consciousness. He had to produce it all out of consciousness. How did he do it? It couldn't be here looking downward into his nothingness. He had to become everything. That's why I said God is center everywhere, circumference nowhere. God is everything. But he brought out of his consciousness what we call reality, which is really just his dream. You and I are his dream. His nature is bliss. His nature is perfect, Satchidananda, absolute existence, consciousness, ever new bliss. And out of that bliss, you and I have come, and that's why we all look for one thing in life. We look for happiness. We look for that bliss that we've lost. But our reality is that, and we will never be satisfied with money, fame, power, nothing until we have found that bliss. Look at the world. Look at history. So many people with so many ambitions, and yet none of them have ever said, I've achieved what I want. Except one class of people. Those who have found God have said, I've found everything I was ever seeking. They are willing to give up their lives to help other people to find that same truth. Because bliss is what all of us are really looking for. And we think bliss will be found in a little bit of human fulfillment and so on, but everything is a compromise. Nothing gives you what you want. You will always be, because how could God create this universe? He had to do it on the principle of duality. It's a vibration, really, of consciousness. And that vibration is like an ocean. When the wave goes up, there has to be a corresponding trough. You can't have any wave changing the level of the ocean. That level has to be there. So for every joy, there has to be a sorrow. For every plus, there has to be a minus. For light, there has to be darkness. Everything in life, you will find this. I remember years ago, and it was a really interesting experience to me because I know these teachings, but I had always dreamed of having a motorhome and going around the country and teaching and sharing music and so on with people. And we finally got this motorhome, and I sat back and laughed and laughed. I was so pleased. And I knew in my mind, I've allowed myself to become emotionally pleased. I'm going to have to pay for it. And I didn't. I just assumed that, of course, I would pay for it. Well, that very evening, when I was on my on one knee, reaching up into a cabinet above there, and Vidura, who was driving, had thought he was stationary. But it was in a parking lot, gradually moving forward so softly that you couldn't feel it until, bang, it hit the side of a supermarket. And I was thrown forward onto the ground, broke a finger, and I had such a good laugh over that. You know, when you see that trouble comes to you, you have to tell yourself, this is great fun, it's showing me something. Don't get all that distraught and desperate about it, because you know that every time, this is a law of life, every time you give in to the exuberance of a success, you will have to have the same kind of failure. And you must reach that point where you're completely in yourself and untouched. And you may think, well, it'll make me just apathetic. How can you enjoy life? The truth is, when you can enjoy it in yourself, you're much happier. Everything, when suffering comes, It's good fun. Really, as long as you can be detached from yourself, nothing really matters. I broke a tooth a few years ago in Assisi, where I was living, and we have a center there too. And it was on New Year's, so I couldn't go to the dentist that day. But the next day I went, and it was right in the front here, broke it off at the gum line. And he said, well, it's going to take 4 visits. First of all, I have to reach in there and kill the nerve. Then I have to sort of drill a post into your jaw, and then I have to do different things before I finally can stick the old tooth back onto the other 4 visits. I said, look, I don't want to keep coming back here. Just do it now. He said, oh, it's going to hurt a lot. I said, don't worry. I don't even want anesthesia. I was just thinking, well, I've lived a long life, and this is just a few moments in that big panorama. Who cares? And so I was letting him go ahead and do it. He cut the nerve and was showing it to some friends. I
kept my eyes closed. Then he drilled this post in there, and in an hour, I was fine, and it didn't hurt me, because I accepted that it would probably hurt a little bit, but it's a small thing. Don't let momentary experiences throw you for a loop. This is what life is all about. In fact, there is always a certain amount of pleasure in misery, and a certain amount of misery in pleasure. When you're very happy with something, there's always a thought, oh, but it won't last. Isn't it? And I remember years ago I was at Carnegie Hall. I had gone that day to get a little dictation machine, and the salesman recorded it into it to make sure it worked, and it was fine. He didn't turn it back to the beginning. Anyway, I was at this concert, and I was thinking Raphael Kubelitz was directing, and in the middle of a movement between, I think it was a Smetana symphony, I thought, well, let me see if this dictation machine will even record something at a distance. So I reached in there and pushed the button. I pushed the wrong button. The whole hall was filled with, hello, testing, one, two. You know, moments of supreme embarrassment don't come that often. He reached four before I could find the stop button. And even at that moment of his extreme embarrassment, I was thinking with self-congratulation, what a story this will be. You'll find some woman, she went to Yogananda and she described this harrowing operation she had had. And finally, he thought, well, my goodness, she's still suffering from it. It must have been just last week. He said, when did you have this operation? Oh, 20 years ago. Why live in such things? You can live at peace and be happy all the time if you understand that your reality is not in this world, which changes from day to night, from heat to cold, from joy to sorrow, from success to failure. This is the nature of reality. Don't let yourself become identified with anything that goes on, but understand that inside there is a reality that never changes. Try to live more in that reality. That's what yoga is all about. That's what the spiritual path is all about. It's not a matter of going to church and being a good fellow. That's very primitive Christianity. And you cannot say, honestly, that those who go to synagogues or viharas or mosques and so on are any better or worse. It's just sort of social religion. Better to have it than not to have anything. Better to believe in God than nothing. But it's not much, frankly. What you need to do is understand that God is the only reality that you'll ever want in your life. This is the only thing you've ever wanted. You've been seeking it without knowing it. And you've been thinking that it would come in money, power, success, etc., etc. It won't come in those things. Always there's something more, and that something more is your own self. It's strange, but every time you go into something and then it disappoints you, you withdraw into yourself, don't you? Before you finally get the energy to go out and try again. Well, the solution is to go into yourself. Meditation. Prayer is calling and talking to God. Meditation is listening for His answer. Meditation is a very important thing. If you're not going to listen to Him, you're not going to be able to know what it's all about. As you go into yourself, you begin to feel a quietness. And in that quietness, you do begin to get answers. You find even in most practical things that you know what you should do. But all of this comes from understanding that you are basically consciousness. Now, that means that you as a person don't really exist, and you might think, well, gosh, I've got hands, I've got legs, what are you talking about? Well, when you die, you just leave that corpse behind. You're more than that. When you understand who you really are, you'll understand that there's a difference between the ego and the infinite. And the more people reach that point, because they've meditated and they begin to see that I'm not just this consciousness, their consciousness expands and they begin to feel. And you can do this in real life too. There's a social way to seek God. Feel for other people. don't take from them, give to them. That's why Jesus said it is more blessed to give than to receive. The more your sympathies expand, the more you feel fulfilled, because you understand you're not just this, but somebody who thinks only what's in it for me, what can I get, I want this, I want that. They are never happy. You look at the most rich millionaire and he's usually miserable. Happiness comes from being in yourself. And this was the truth of the life of Jesus. There are two expressions he used, and the scribes didn't get it straight, so they misquoted him sometimes. But Yogananda explained that he said there are two things. One is Son of Man, the other is Son of God. The Son of Man was his physical body, but Son of God means this. And this Trinity is a true dogma. It's a truth. Why call it dogma? When God created everything, he did it in motion. A certain little portion of the surface of his consciousness, of Spirit's consciousness, vibrated in motion to produce all manifestation. And that is the Holy Spirit or Holy Ghost, what they call in India, Om. And then when that vibration is moving, then it produces more and more subtle, and everything is made of vibration. We are vibration. But as you understand it, first of all, it becomes in thought. Then that thought vibrates more grossly and becomes energy. Then that energy finally vibrates most grossly and becomes a body and rocks and all those things. It can't go any further than that. That infinite freedom becomes encased in apparent solidity of rocks. But those rocks aren't real, and science has proved that too. This is why we're living in an age when science and religion can and must come together. And this was the mission of Yogananda, to show that science and religion and all truth are one. But one thing I've said in this book is that science can do no more than rummage in the cosmic pantry to find something to nibble on. It can't go deep into things. If you could find the absolute final truth of an atom even, or electron, you would know God. But the trouble is you can't, because it's outside you. There's only one little atom you could ever know to its basic source, and that is you. If you know who and what you are, you discover that you are in everybody. This ego, it's a very good thing to practice deliberately, not pushing your ego. When people are talking, don't say, well, well, what about me? Don't think that way. I was at a party one time. In fact, it was a conference, and it was on starting communities, and I was the only person among the speakers who had actually started and developed a successful community. But some of them felt that they were better known and more important, and I invited a group of them out to dinner. I was paying the bill, but they paid no attention to me. And we're all talking to each other. I thought this is an absolutely marvelous occasion. It's a reminder of how totally unimportant I am, and I felt so free. I remember one time I went into Ananda, walking up through some of the woods there and seeing lights, and I thought, well, years ago there was nothing but darkness here, and now there's light. I did that. Then I stepped back and I said, well, do I like that thought? No, it's so confining. It was done and I don't have to tie myself to it. I felt so free. I've never had that question or that thought in my mind again. Because what we do, God does it. Yogananda used to say, when you lecture, let God talk through you. And I remember one time when I was in the Hollywood Church of SRF here on Sunset Boulevard, I used to be the minister there. And this was in about 1955. And I thought, well, Master told me, you might call my guru Master, he told us that we should let God talk through us. So I thought, well, maybe I should just shut up and let God do the job. So I stopped talking. Well, if I were in front of all of you right now and I were to stop talking for 2 minutes, I think you'd get a little anxious. I stood there perfectly comfortable for 2 minutes. And I realized he was not going to say anything. And then I realized that Yogananda had said, I will reason, I will, I will act, but guide thou my reason, will, and activity to the right path in everything. When I have written music, for example, I don't just sit there and say, well, God, you do something. It won't happen that way. But it doesn't happen if I say, well, I want to do this, I want to do that. I'm looking for what people will think of me. If you can get rid of that thought, you'll find that inspiration just flows. I remember years ago one little piece that I had to write. It was based on a series of slides I'd taken of the Amalfi Coast in Italy. And I had been to Pompeii. And I wanted to do music for Pompeii. Well, I couldn't just say, well, God, give me a melody. But I did say, I want this melody to express certain things. Tragedy, but not that great a tragedy. After all, it was 2,000 years ago, and things have changed since then. The sins that people may have committed that drew that, but after all, in 2,000 years, maybe they've expiated those sins. And so I had certain clear thoughts that I wanted. And then I said, give me a melody. It came just like that. You have to tell God what you want. If you're a mathematician, he's not going to give you poetry. If you're a poet, he won't give you music, or he won't give you mathematical formulae, but he does answer. That infinite consciousness, you are a part of it. And if you raise your consciousness to it, you will be amazed at how much flows through you. I've written books on subject that I don't know anything about, and yes, I did. When I wrote my book on the art of supportive leadership, well, I've been a leader all my life, in a sense, but I've understood leadership, so maybe it's from my own experience that I did get it. But nonetheless, it came to me from even being a leader. I understood that leadership is not self-importance. That's a way to get you bound. Leadership is service. Leadership is not being more important. It's just that if you have that talent, so you can use it. But to serve other people, to help them cooperate and work cooperatively in a venture, not to sort of stand there and tell people what to do, but let them to tell as much as possible. This is how I built Ananda. The real secret of building communities is people. And so I've evolved several basic principles. One is an Indian one, an ancient one. Jato dharma tato jaya. Where there is dharma or right action, there is victory. Another one is people are more important than things. And at Ananda, if we have a job to be done, but it won't be good for anybody we know, we don't bother with the job. We just say, it's all right. People. Communities are people. The most important thing is that, not whether we succeed in this. I've never worried about success. People said when I started a community that you're bound to fail, that's never succeeded. I said, I'm not interested in whether I succeed or fail. It's something I believe in and something I have to do. Since the age of 15, I've wanted to do it. But it worked. And we're here to say that next year we'll be celebrating our 40th anniversary. But that is to be understood always, that if you let God have a play a part in your life, ask him for guidance. You have to ask. You have to talk. You have to do things. But at the same time, ask him to guide your reason. Every time you do or think anything, he'll tell you maybe to go to the next corner, but if you just keep going in that direction, you may be erring. He may want you to turn right at that corner. So it means always asking, is this right? Is this right? You will feel a certain confirmation in your heart, and the more you practice this, the more you find that you are right. I remember back in Palo Alto, the lady who ran the East-West bookstore there many years ago, she said, I'm getting old and I would like to retire. Would Ananda like to buy this store from me? And I didn't even spend a long time thinking. I just went inside and I felt, yes. I said, yes, we will. We didn't have any money. Where were we going to get it from? But it came. God has done so many amazing things and I've found that he will do it. If you try to serve him, if you try to do something that will further his harmony and joy and love in this world. He is no myth, and he's not beyond the galaxies. He's right in your own heart. And this is what Jesus came to tell us. It's what Yogananda came to tell us. There have been in history people who have known God, and they have always been completely fulfilled in their lives. They're the only group of people who are fulfilled. Now, with Christianity, Yogananda came to help us to see. In fact, this is the truth, and you can accept it or not as you choose. But he said that Jesus Christ appeared to Babaji, the first of our line of gurus in the Himalaya, and Jesus said, "What is happening to my church? They do good works, but they've forgotten communion with God. Let us together send a new ray to the West." And this is what Yogananda said. He had been sent by Jesus to the West to bring this teaching of what Christianity is really all about, to know God, to love God, to make Him a reality in your life, and not just something sort of waiting for you when you die. The reality of spirituality is that when you get rid of your ego, you begin to realize that you are everything. Read Autobiography of a Yogi, that fantastic chapter, An Experience in Cosmic Consciousness, and that wonderful poem, Samadhi, where he experiences this oneness. The ego disappears, matter disappears, and he realizes that he is a part of that great oneness. But you have to see, just logically even, what else can you possibly be? You have to be a part of that consciousness. Your destiny in the end is to get rid of this thought that I'm separate from that. But the thought in the mind always is, but if I'm separate from that, if I merge into that, I'll lose myself. The truth is you don't. That's the amazing thing about it. Because in omniscience, you always remember that you were Joe or Jean, whatever, and that you went through all these different incarnations and then became that same thing again. And that is how when an incarnation of God, an avatar, when he is born, it is that particular memory that is reawakened. Jesus came. Remember in the book of Revelation, he said, "Those who have overcome, I will make a pillar in the temple of God, in the mansion of my God, even as I myself overcame, even as I also overcame, and am set down with my Father in the infinite." My quote is not exact, but you remember how he used that expression, "even as I overcame." It wasn't that he overcame just after 40 days in the wilderness. He had overcome through many lifetimes. He knew our sufferings. He knew God doesn't get angry with you if you sin. For heaven's sake, he's pitted. He's sort of made. The setup is very much against you from the beginning. Comes in. It takes a long time, many incarnations, before people gradually learn what it's all about. You can't learn it quickly. If you look at a group like this, or any group on a city street, you can see that it's not just genes who made that. Many, many incarnations of experience. You've had all kinds of things, but always, and this is the amazing thing, you have always been you. Even when you get rid of your ego, that manifestation of God as your individual soul, your individual self is individual. It's not as if you merge back and become everything and nothing and who knows what. There will always be that memory of that particular experience you went through. And if you choose, or if God wills, that you come back, and avatars come back not from desire, as most people do, but out of their deep compassion for people, having suffered all this themselves for lifetimes, how can you not feel compassion for other people who are still suffering, still going through this maze of delusion and confusion? And so some few, but not many, most people when they reach that stage, they think, "Oh, at last, I'm free of it." But there are a few. There's a story that Ramakrishna told about three men who left a village and they came to a wall. And they'd never seen that wall before and they wondered what's on the other side. So they said, "Well, let's make a pact. If the two of us can help the third to get up on top, he can tell us what he sees." And so they managed to get one on somebody's shoulder, and then the other one got on his shoulder, and he got to the top of the wall, and he stood on it and looked down on the other side and clapped his hands joyfully and jumped down, and the others waited and waited. And he never came back. And so the second one said, "Well, I'll certainly tell you." And so they managed somehow to find a tree stump, and he stood on his second man got on his shoulders and managed to clamber up there. And he got on the top of the wall, and he looked down, and he clapped his hands, and he jumped over on the other side, and he said, "Oh, this is great." And the third one said, "Well, goodness sake, what am I going to do? I really have to know what's over there." And he found a tree, and he managed to lean this tree against, a dead tree against the wall, and clamber up there. And he got to the top of the wall, and he saw the most beautiful garden he'd ever seen. His only thought was, "Oh, let me enjoy this forever." And then he thought, "But if I jump, all those people in my village, they'll never know about this." And so he decided to delay his happiness in going in there in order to come back and help his fellow villagers to know about this wonderful freedom. There is a story Yogananda told, a vision that he had as a young man. He was standing in a marketplace in India, and there was dirt and noise and confusion. And every now and then somebody would look at a point behind Yogananda, and there was a look of inexpressible yearning would come into his eyes. And he would look as if he wanted, and then he said, "Oh, but it's much too high for me," and he'd go back to his life. And this happened several times when Yogananda thought, "Well, I must see what's back there." So he turned around and he saw the most beautiful mountain and a wonderful garden on the top of it. But it seemed so high. His first thought was, "Oh, it's much too high for me." Then he thought, "But I can at least take one step at a time." And so doing that, he came finally up to the top and reached that garden. You don't have to worry about where you are on the spiritual path. If you take one step at a time, God doesn't hate you if you don't do the right thing. For God's sakes, he knows that you're not going to do the right thing, probably. But his love is always there calling to you and come home. We are all prodigal sons, and we've been wandering in this land of delusion, and finally remember our home. And when you seek him, yes, it's a long job. Yes, it's a difficult job, but there's no other thing to do, for God's sake. I mean, when you've got everything else stacked against you, you don't have a choice, really. But most people think, "Oh, but I can become a famous pianist. I can become a famous scientist. I can become this." And so they go back. One time I asked my guru if I'd been his disciple a long time. I won't say how long. And he said, "It's been a long time. That's all I'll say." I said, "But sir, does it always take that long?" Oh, he said, "Yes, desires for this thing and that thing take them away again and again. It's just gradually that you do find it. It's not a quick thing, but you can find it quickly. Do you know that everybody on earth is just about as close to God as the greatest saints? The only trouble is that they're looking in different directions. They're thinking it's here, it's there. If they could really convince their minds that what I'm looking for is here, they would find that you were that close to God right now. You must know him in time. It's an inevitable thing. Why waste time? Even a little bit of seeking God, even Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, if you give God even a leaf or a flower, he will bless you. The more you turn in the direction of the sun, the more you feel its heat. The more you turn away and walk in shadow, the less you feel its heat. Just turn toward God a little bit in your life, and you'll find that any little bit that you give to him and offer to him, somehow it becomes blessed. Somehow it becomes sweeter. Your life becomes so sweet when you feel him. I've been doing this now for nearly 60 years. I'm still a baby. And yet I have to say that there's so much bliss. I sometimes can hardly stand it. It's there. It's waiting for you. Don't think that you are important in any way. He is everything. And once you've realized that, that Christ consciousness, which was, I started to talk about the Trinity. The Spirit became Om. But in the heart of every vibration, at the very center of every vibration, is the reflection of the infinite. That calm, unmoving reality, because the movement is still a delusion. The center of every movement is that point in the middle. That is the Christ consciousness. It's the only begotten because in all creation, in all material creation, astral, causal, all vibration, there is that one consciousness. He is the only begotten, because that is... I asked my guru one time, what must one have achieved to become a master? He said one must have achieved at least Christ consciousness. When Jesus was when we speak of the Son of God, we're speaking of that part of Jesus which knew by his own realization that infinite and he were one. First of all, you go in meditation and then you begin to feel the Om sound. I can't teach you this technique now, but I would urge you to learn it. Listen to Om, and at the beginning you'll sort of hear it in the right ear. It'll be a very pleasing sound. Then as you hear it more deeply, you'll know it's the only thing in the world you could listen to and never get tired of. And then gradually it'll come into your body, and you feel your whole body shaking with that sound. Then you'll feel it expanding outward, and this is known as Om Samadhi, when you know that you are in Om, in that reality, and that your body is nothing compared to that. Oh, but these are deep teachings, and I can't go into it greatly, but the thing is that once you realize that, then you discover that at the center of the movement of your own vibration, there is the Christ consciousness. And when you can go into that consciousness, then you gradually expand it to infinity. That is Christ consciousness, not until then. And that is what the saints of all religions have achieved. And that is why when Yogananda came to see Teresa Neumann of Bavaria in Germany, she sent a message saying, "The bishop has told me not to see anybody, but I will see the man of God from India." And when he talked about in his book, Autobiography of a Yogi, about having experienced the visions that she had of Christ's passion and crucifixion, years later, a Catholic manual or magazine said as if a Hindu yogi could have a true Catholic vision. Well, the fact is that visions are visions. It doesn't matter what your belief system is, it matters what your heart is. You can believe in nothing, but if you know in your heart, you've known. Understanding grows not by believing and becoming more and more locked in dogmatism and bigotry. We must understand that science itself has given us the key. Scientists may be foolish because they're so egotistical that they can't imagine any consciousness greater than their own. But the scientific idea that the brain is what produces consciousness is wrong. Descartes was wrong when he said, "Je pense, donc je suis," I think, therefore I am. What the truth is that I am conscious of being and therefore I am able to think. But St. Teresa of Avila said that there are stages of prayer where you go beyond thought. You can't think. Your mind is held. That's when you're really aware. It isn't by thinking that you achieve things. You can't find the truth by thinking your way to them. I used to try to do that when I was a teenager. And when I met my guru, he told me and showed me that the answer is love, devotion. The mind won't give you satisfaction. Devotion will. There's such sweetness that comes when you begin to feel love, because it isn't as if just you are loving. His love comes into you. He is a reality. And you can experience that reality the calmer you are. The purpose of Yogananda's life was above all to help us to discover who we are as children of God and to realize that we are a part of that. This is what Christianity was. This is what Jesus came to teach us, how we too can become like him. He didn't come to show us how great he was. He came to show us how great we are in our potential. So, well, I think I've talked long enough. It's been a blessing for me to be here, and thank you for coming. Joy to you. If anything I have said resonates, it's because it's in you. Okay.
Thank you, Swamiji, so much for that. It was a beautiful talk. Now we come to the awards part of our evening. As Davey mentioned before, Swamiji won a couple of awards in Rome, and his hot streak has continued. This evening, we're delighted to present to Swamiji two different awards that he has won. The first award will be presented by Priya Rogers, Los Angeles Yoga Fellowship. Priya Rogers is an Ananda Yoga teacher and who has a very unique approach to how she's built her yoga practice. She lives in San Pedro. She does not have a yoga studio. Instead, she travels to a variety of different organizations and does yoga classes there. Most interestingly, one of them is the Fort MacArthur Air Base, where she is teaching yoga to the military. And it's not just the wives or family members who are coming to our classes. It is actually the military and military officers that she's teaching yoga to, and they love it. She also takes her yoga classes to a downtown Los Angeles law firm and to a doctor's office and to the YMCA. She has an amazing practice, and now we'd like to bring up Priya to present the 2007 Pioneer in Yoga Award.
Good evening, great souls. I'm truly blessed to be here in the presence of Swamiji. Listening to you has really inspired me. And one affirmation that really comes to my heart is, I'm calm, I'm poised. This wasn't the way it was when I entered this theater today. I would like to truly thank Swamiji for touching my life with your expanding light and for showing direction to my hometown, New Delhi, India, where I'm from. On behalf of the Los Angeles Yoga Fellowship, I am proud to present Swami Kriyananda with the Pioneer in Yoga Award. The Pioneer in Yoga Award recognizes spiritual teachers who have made the eternal truths of yoga accessible in fresh new ways, ways that are not only practical and easily applicable for the modern audience, but also completely faithful to the ancient yoga tradition. Swami Kriyananda personifies this pioneering spirit in yoga community. He has dedicated 60 years to sharing the universal spiritual teachings of yoga through thousands of lectures throughout the world, through his 90 books which have been translated into nearly 30 languages, and through his daily television program which reaches millions worldwide. Never altering the most profound message of yoga and bringing clarity of expression to it for our age, he is an outstanding exponent and beautiful example of the very best that yoga has to give. The Los Angeles Yoga Fellowship is honored to present you with this Pioneer in Yoga Award, Swamiji. Thank you for blazing a spiritual trail that leads to the highest goal, yoga, scientific union with spirit.
I'll say a few words. I have to say that Yogananda had me teaching the yoga postures whenever he had guests, and I was in their magazine, I was the one who demonstrated them and so on. It was really not my doing. There was a group of us whom he had together to show yoga postures, and I had been okay, but there were certain ones I simply couldn't do. Suddenly in his presence, I found I could do them all with ease, and from then on I became the sort of expert, but it was his power. Anyway, I evolved a system of yoga called Ananda Yoga, which is showing, it emphasizes the balance, the interrelationship of body, mind, and soul. And the postures are means of helping you to develop, not just physically, but mentally and spiritually. And this I received from him, and I do recommend to everybody that they, if they want to study yoga, that they think in terms of this particular brand of yoga. There's another thing that I wanted to read from my book In Divine Friendship on the subject of yoga, because many times people ask, but is yoga safe? I say, yes, the danger from yoga practice is, as you say, namely, that it can make one self-centered if he thinks only of developing himself. It can also be harmful if one practices violent breathing exercises, which can awaken energies before the body is ready to receive them. There is another aspect to yoga, however, that makes it a much safer path than the well-known path of mystical love and prayer. In the West, many saints have suffered in their bodies from the inflow of divine grace. No, they weren't destroyed by grace, and their suffering gradually became transmuted into perfect attunement with the divine flow. They might have been spared much suffering physically, however. What happened to them, especially as grace first began to operate in their bodies, was like turning water on at a faucet before straightening out the hose. A strong flow of water can straighten out the hose, true, but how much better if we take the time to straighten it ourselves? The lashing back and forth which ensues as the water straightens the hose can create a degree of havoc. So it is that the practice of yoga involves not only awakening energies, but also, and even more specifically, opening up the channel of the spine so that the flow of grace can enter the body unimpeded. Not knowing what was happening, Western mystics and saints have often suffered physically, at least until finally the purification process ended. We don't find that sort of thing happening nearly so much among yogis. In fact, then, yoga is very much the safer path. It is important, however, not to do the more violent exercises that one finds available in books and from certain organizations. Would God allow a person to be destroyed by these energies? I cannot imagine him doing so, and know of no case to justify such a doubt. As Krishna says, however, in the Bhagavad Gita, O Arjuna, know this for certain, my devotee is never lost. Okay?
The second award that Swamiji has won tonight will be presented by Paula T. Webb from the National Interfaith Council. After 20 years in the investment industry in corporate America, Paula T. Webb founded the Path to Fulfillment Institute, which provides classes and counseling on creative prosperity and personal achievement from a spiritual perspective. In her work as an interfaith minister, she is the current president and founder of the National Interfaith Council, an organization devoted to promoting respect and understanding for all philosophies and spiritual paths. She's the author of several books, including the acclaimed Creating Perfect Relationships. So now I'd like to call up Paula T. Webb to present this year's Beacon of Light Lifetime Achievement Award.
Welcome, and thank you for that loving introduction. Namaste. I'm honored to be here with all of you here this evening and share this auspicious and life-changing event with all of you. As Sean has already noted, I am founder of these two institutes which provide loving services. And both of these institutes, as he mentioned, have their beginnings in corporate America. For years, while working for top-level CEOs, as well as the U.S. Senate, I found that, for the most part, there was little or no opportunity to express my individual or any of the other staff's spirituality while at work. For example, how many of you here remember when Good Friday was a legal holiday, where most businesses closed early? Anybody? In my experience, even though it was a legal holiday, most of the executives that I worked for would usually make it extremely difficult for the office staff to leave early to attend church or even just take the rest of the day off as they so desired. It didn't matter whether the executives were Christian or not, or if they themselves were even at the office, which they usually weren't. The desire to be in control of the staff far outweighed any sense of personal spirituality any of us would want to express on that particular day. And for years, most of us would be subtly but definitely ridiculed or mocked about wanting to leave early or go to church. And so we would usually stay at our desk and fume about it the rest of the day, and even possibly longer. After this happened for a number of years, it finally dawned on me that I could still express my own sense of spirituality while at work, quietly and to myself. I could have one simple moment, a moment of silence. It didn't matter where that moment of silence might be. It could be at my desk, it could be in the lunchroom, an empty boardroom, or even in one of the stalls in the ladies' room. But I could still take my moment of silence and create my sense of spirituality outside of anybody else's idea of that. Pretty simple, right? To express our universal, God-given sense of spirituality, all we ever need is one moment, one thought, one step, as Kriyananda has already said earlier this evening. And isn't that simply beautiful? And as such, my institutes and books are based on that universally simple phrase, one thought, one step towards God. I was very fortunate to be asked to read Swami Kriyananda's book, Revelations of Christ, before it was published. And I found it to be very revealing. Revealing in the sense that it gives the reader, rather all of us, especially those of us raised with an organized religious background, permission, shall I say, to truly seek universal truth for ourselves in our own way, and not necessarily the truth that someone else may have taught us. I was indeed blessed to read his book, and more so, I am even more blessed to be here this evening with all of you. At our National Interfaith Council, every 3 months or so, we honor one of our esteemed members, or someone we may know, with our Beacon of Light Award. The Beacon of Light Award is just that, an honor for someone or an organization that is truly being a beacon of light in today's world. A beacon of light without dogma, without fanaticism, but just a beacon coming from a space of love. And the award is always given through divine inspiration, meaning I will always be shown who should be honored in this manner. To quote Yogananda, in your heart must well that sympathy with which soothes away all pain from the hearts of others. And in my estimation and in my opinion, Swami Kriyananda throughout his life has demonstrated his deep and abiding understanding of that quote through his universal love for mankind. He has tirelessly written books, composed songs, and created retreat centers founded within comprehensive understanding of that simple quote as well as upon universal truth. And so to honor him this evening as founder of the National Interfaith Council, I have created this special first edition, one-of-a-kind Beacon of Light Lifetime Achievement Award. And now, to Swami Kriyananda, I would like to bless you with our award in honor of your unending and loving work to heal the hearts of all mankind.
I am grateful for this honor which I lay at the feet of my guru. Without him, I would be nobody. And I'm so grateful that he has been able to use me in some small way to help other people. The only thing I have wanted is to, whatever I find in life, share it with other people. I'm so glad I could be here. Thank you. The mountains, peace gave us the sky. Nightly, when starlight enfolds us, peace is its lullaby. Join us in singing Amen. Amen. May God and Christ bless you. Thank you.